Okay, so here we go. First question for today. In the suttas, there are quite a few examples where lay people become stream anchors, sotapannas, and then return to lay life. For example, the brothers who both became sotapannas, and one became a monk while the other went back to his wife and house. Okay. If you said it's a requirement to be, yet you said it is a requirement to be a monastic, please comment. It's not really a requirement to be a monastic. I don't think I said that because there's no such thing in the suttas as a requirement. So I, what I'm saying is that people will be on kind of different stages on the path. Some will choose to be monastics because they are inclining that way. And other people will still remain as householders, even though they are stream entries or sotapannas. There are examples of people who are anagamis, non-returners, who are still lay people. So the only category really in the suttas that you find where people tend always to be monastic is when you are fully awakened, when you're an arahant. And the reason for that is because you basically have given up anything that has to do with the household life. You can't really attached to anything anymore. You can't really store things up. You can't do anything that has to do with household life. So even if you happen to live in a house, you wouldn't be a householder in any ordinary sense. You would have given up everything that has to do with householdership. So you are, in all essence, a monastic from that point onwards. So yeah, there's lots of examples of lay people in the suttas who are Aryas, are sotapannas, etc. But of course the reason why the Buddha lays down the monastic path is because it is the best way to actually achieve these states. That's the whole point of it, right? You can imagine that there is great advantage of living in a monastery and living among other people who share your lifestyle. Everybody support each other. You have a teacher who has a lot of experience, right? Teacher who hopefully has seen these things themselves and then carries everybody along here. And you live in a very supportive environment, which is very supportive for these things. You kind of think about Dhamma most of the day and you go back to a kuti by yourself in the forest. There's an incredible benefit of being a monastic if you want to practice this path. And still, often, it is not that easy to... it still takes a long time to make this kind of breakthrough. So it is possible as a layperson, but I think generally speaking, it is fair to say that it is less likely because the conditions just aren't as supportive. That's the only reason. It's not because lay people are worse or better or anything like that. It's just that the conditions aren't as supportive, and that is obviously enough reason for it to be less likely that you will make the breakthrough. So. Okay, so I hope that is makes sense. Okay, next one. Dear Ajahn, I appreciate if you could explain organ donation from a Buddhist perspective. If organ donation is performed when a person has no hope of recovering, is going to die soon, but the spiritual being is still within the physical body, the spiritual being can feel the pain on the extraction of the organ. And this pain could lead one to a lesser place of next rebirth, as one is not able to die peacefully in the final moments. Thank you. That's an interesting question. At what point should organ donation happen? And I agree with you. Basically, organ donation should ideally happen after your mind has left the body, right? So you don't actually have an attachment to that body anymore. As long as the mind still as mind and body are together, there's obviously going to be some attachment to the body. And imagine somebody coming and starting to, cut you up and kind of pulling out the organs. It can be quite traumatic. You can imagine that. But on the other hand, it can also be a beautiful experience. Imagine that you are already leaving your body, right? And you have made a will whereby you say that I'm very happy to give away my organs. And then you see that they come and they help somebody else survive by taking your organs, right? That's the last thing you see as you move on to your next life. What a wonderful thing that is, if you see that. It's like your last piece of generosity. Even your physical body you give away, right? So there is, I think that is the kind of the beautiful thing about this, is the potential for it to be a beautiful act of generosity. And that is what we should, what this kind of thing should aim for. But you're right, we should be careful that I think ideally the person should be considered absolutely dead before you take the organs. I don't really know enough about how these things function to be able to answer this question fully, because I don't know if it is how common it is to take organs while the body is still alive. You know, if you give up on somebody, they're in coma or whatever, and you think that there's no hope for survival, whether they actually take, sometimes I think they take organs at that point. And that is a good question, whether that is the ideal way of doing it. But not 100% sure about that. Okay. Dear Ajahn, if sila is our habit, and habit is conditioned by our past and environment. Okay, so is the sila our habit, and habit is conditioned by past and environment? If we want to change our habit to wholesome state, the only way we can do is change ourselves and the environment. If family is one of our close environments, should we reduce the quantity we meet our family to create a wholesome habit? Thank you. There isn't really any, you know, there is no answer to these things. I think one of the things that I always like to quote from the Buddha, which always to me has been one of the most powerful things that he taught, which I find incredibly useful in my monastic life and life in general, he said that whatever you decide in life, whatever you do, the decision should be made only on one criteria. And that criteria is whether what you're doing is going to lead you to more wholesome states and less unwholesome states, and not to more unwholesome states and less wholesome states. That's the only criteria. So you have to decide for yourself if you find that being around people too much, and often that's true, right? If you are around people too much, they often stir us up. And family have a very great ability to stir us up, because the habits are so ingrained with family, right? They're so ingrained, they come around, and then they stir us up because of that. So sometimes it can be useful, perhaps, to reduce the overall impact on the amount of time we spend with our family. And sometimes what happens is that something positive comes out of that, because your family may realize that suddenly the quality of the interaction is greater, right? Suddenly you have more kindness, more patience for them. You have more time in a kind of good way for your family members, rather than just spending lots of time, which is really isn't very high quality here. So, you know, often we need to balance this kind of quantity with quality and decide what really matters the most. So, yes, I think that there is something to be said for that, and you have to decide. Obviously, you have to find that balance, because sometimes there are social expectations that you are with your family. Often family expect you to see you every so often. So you have to find the right balance for yourself, and only you can know what that balance actually is. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn, with some sense desires, e.g. a desire for addictive drugs or gambling, it is relatively easy to see that the dangers outweigh the benefits and it leads to afflictions. With others, e.g. desire for a fulfilling romantic relationship, is not so easy to see the dangers outweigh the benefits. What if someone desires a relationship with someone also committed to the Dhamma? Okay, so if you're already married to the Dhamma, how can you be married to someone else? Is that what you're saying? Yes. Okay, while any such attachment carries dangers of loss and heartache, it is not clear how on balance it must lead to overall affliction if pursued. It might make my life go better rather than worse. Okay, but the point here is that yes, it perhaps in the short run and for a while it might make it go better, but it must always end in heartache. That's the problem. It always ends with suffering, right? Every time you're attached to something, the end point must always be suffering, because the end point must always be a separation. So you're always kind of looking forward to suffering every time you're attached to something, and this is the problem. And it is hard sometimes, I think, to realize what it means to kind of just be by yourself and live a very kind of free life as a monastic, just hanging out in your kuti by yourself. It's a very, I don't know, I find it a very liberating experience. You feel very free. You feel like, you know, as it said in that sutta I read the other day, like the bird with its only wings, you know, with its wings as its only burden. And there's a sense of freedom there, a liberation from this... A sense of encroachment almost of society and people is very beautiful. The problem is that attachment always leads in the end, it always leads to suffering, and it always must end in that. This is the first thing. The second thing is that yes, you may find a fulfilling relationship. The more fulfilling it is, the more attached you're going to be to the other person. If you are attached to the other person, it means you have a vested interest in how they act, right? You are attached to them because they are in a certain way. You are attached to them because they like you. If they start liking somebody else, or they start acting in a way that you don't like, you're going to suffer. And very often we try to control the other person. If you try to control the other person, they will rebel. They will, you know, they won't like that. So there's all kinds of complications that come from these things. There's no such thing as a romantic relationship that is just romantic. It doesn't exist. There's always little things, little problems with these things. I look at my own parents. My own parents have been married for, 50 years or whatever. And they, you know, they're quite rare these days. They never got divorced or anything like that. But still, when I look at their marriage, okay, they have a good relationship by all standards. But would I want to live in that sort of relationship? The honest answer is not really. You see, they've been around for so long, and there are so many habits. They react to each other in such predictable ways, right? It's almost scary how predictable it is sometimes. You can see one thing happening and then the other person reacts like this. And sometimes it's nice, but other times it's not so nice. And when I see that I don't want to live like that. Of course, it's easy to have the conceit that I'm going to be different from my parents, right? Because I'm wiser. I have kind of seen something else. But I think the reality is that we tend to end up pretty much exactly like our parents. That's just how things are. Or like anybody else for that matter. We are pretty much the same, right? We have the same desires. We have the same way of relating to people in this world. It's very hard to be completely different from everybody else, because psychologically our makeup is roughly the same. We have the same thing we want, the same thing we desire out of life. And then, of course, there's all the problems, right? The relationship starts as a romantic thing, then your partner leaves you, right? They had enough. You are still attached, but they want to go. Tremendously painful, right? It's very difficult to take. And all of these things is what you can expect. This is part and parcel of what happens to everybody in life. We don't want to see that part, but it is the reality. And then sometimes, you know, some of the worst crimes, if you look at crime statistics in the world of murder and violence and all these kind of things, a lot of the crime in the world, in terms of especially these areas, are crimes of passion, right? The people we murder the most in this world are our family members, the people we love, our wife or husband. These are the people that usually kind of cop this kind of behavior, and because it is the power of the defilements that drive this, the passion, the attachment, the desire is so strong that we end up doing very, very bad things as a consequence. So, and this is the danger in sensual pleasure. It is a very strong danger. It's very hard to see. When you're in love, it's almost impossible to see that, right? Oh, everything is so wonderful. You can't see clearly what is going on. And the only way that you're going to see this clearly is to reflect on it again and again and again. to understand what is happening, yeah? And gradually you will start to see the big picture. Yeah? The only way to really be able to see this is to enter a state of meditation, a state where all these desires cease completely, yeah? And understand the liberation, yeah? And the bliss with all attachment and all sensuality, all your desire for the sensual objects of the five senses, it ceases completely, it's completely gone. Only then have you got enough distance that you can actually see the happiness that arises from that. It's the happiness in the sutta that's called the Nekama Sukha, the happiness of non-desire, right? The happiness of not being attached to any sensual objects whatsoever. And it's an incredibly superior happiness. In the suttas, it's called the Sambodha Sukha, the happiness of awakening. You're getting into the realm of what it means to be fully enlightened according to the Buddhist path when you're moving into this area. It's a completely different, you know, what they call paradigm. It's a completely different way of looking at the world. You're stepping out of the whole sensual realm that we are so immersed in all the time. And you're stepping into a new dimension which is completely different. We are so immersed in this realm. Everything we ever feel, we see things, we hear things, we taste things, we smell things, we have physical contact. We're so immersed in these five senses. It's very hard to understand what it is to withdraw completely, absolutely from that and experience the world from a completely different perspective. But that is what meditation is about, is the withdrawal from this world and understanding the world when once you are withdrawn from this. And it is, certainly as the Buddha said so, it's an incredibly happy state to be able to withdraw from this world. Only then can you understand the limitations of romantic relationships, of all these kind of things. You can understand that actually there are very serious problems with that. Okay, so, sorry about that. This is what the Buddha said, right? I'm just saying what the Buddha said. This is just a kind of straight Dhamma, nothing else. Anyway, so dear Ajahn, when to actively purify, when to passively observe? Thank you. Okay, so when you actively purify, okay, when you actively restrain, maybe use the word restrain. So sometimes when the defilements are so strong and you see yourself about to do something wrong, you hold back, you pull yourself back and you say, no, I'm not going to go there. Sometimes the kind of the power of the momentum of what is driving you is so powerful that you have to hold back willfully to be able to stop yourself. So sometimes it is right to use willpower and to use force to hold yourself back. So in daily life, very often we have to use a certain amount of activity in daily life, because daily life is there's so much activity going on, you can't really stop yourself usually just by observing in ordinary life. Being a passive observer is really for meditation practice. But there's always a degree of room for active purification, because all I mean here, but what we're talking about here with active purification is just a shift in attention, right? So you are looking at something and it gives rise to a negative mind state. It gives rise to irritation or whatever. So why is it that it gives rise to irritation? It's because you're looking at that situation in a certain way. You're focusing on the bad qualities in that person, and that's why irritation arises. So then what you do, you shift your attention to the good qualities. How? Because you have already built up a store in your mind, an understanding that there are so many good qualities there. You know that already. So that is already in your mind, waiting to be kind of made use of, right? And when you see the irritation about to rise, you quickly, you change your mind, you change your view to all those beautiful qualities. And this is what you can do, you know, particularly when you are with a good group of people. When I stay in the monastery, and I think of, go back to my cute, I think of all the wonderful qualities of my fellow monastics. And there's so many good qualities there. So when I see sometimes that irritation arises, which it always will do, when you live closely around people, there's always going to be irritations. That's just the nature of living around people all the time. But because I understand, I know that there are so many good qualities there, all I have to do sometimes is shift my attention quickly, remember those good qualities, and the irritation just evaporates just like that. So this is what This is really the way to actively purify, right? Or you see that if you are a monastic, you see that you are attracted to somebody, right? And then you quickly remind yourself of the danger in that attraction, so that you actually can cut that off as soon as possible, so it doesn't cause you any problems. So this is what you have to do. Of course, in lay life, you know, you cannot really pursue the ending of sensual desire in quite the same way as you do monastics, because as a lay person, usually you are involved in a relationship, and that's okay, that's fine. You try instead to put boundaries around the sensuality. You don't take it outside certain limits. So there's a slightly different way of practicing there. But when you come on a retreat like this, it's actually useful to use some of the techniques to overcome the sensuality of the world, to actually be able to purify yourself a little bit more. Okay, I hope that makes sense. Anyway, so I'll go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, does a nimitta have to be visual when the breath and body disappear? I sometimes experience an incredible, powerful and beautiful feeling that moves into deep tranquility. But this is not visual whatsoever. Should I look out for a visual sign? The answer is probably yes. If you look at how some of these things are taught in the suttas, the Buddha also talks about light in the mind, the lights that can arise, the obhasa. This is particularly in the Upakilesa Sutta and the Majjhima Nikaya 128. It talks about obhasa and the seeing of form. Obhasa is brightness or light, right? So it is there, and that happens just before you enter jhana, according to that sutta. So that seems to be the normal way that people experience this. But of course, before even you have these lights in the mind, these nimittas, there will be very often powerful feelings, very strong, positive, happy feelings going on, moving into tranquility. They will often be there already. So remember, this is a stage-by-stage thing, right? And the thing is, that's the bliss. You know, when you hear people who have a lot of experience with very deep samadhis, they say that the bliss sometimes is just outlandish. It kind of goes from stage to stage to stage. And sometimes they say that sometimes there's so much bliss, you don't know if you can take any more of all the bliss. It's just so absolutely overpowering. So this is the kind of the path. You start to feel a little bit happiness and bliss and rapture and joy. And then you feel more. And then you feel more, right? And then you feel even more. And it kind of keeps on going like that. And so this is the very fact that you already have a very beautiful and powerful feeling leading to tranquility doesn't mean that this isn't going to be even more powerful in the future, and then perhaps conjoined with powerful nimittas as well. I'm not 100% sure. It doesn't say in the suttas, the Buddha doesn't say that you have to have these things. They're not actually mentioned, the impression I have is that is the general and usual path that people go through before they go into deep states of samadhi. So just be open about things. Don't have any particular view about this, and let's see what happens. Just keep on going in this direction. Keep on feeling the tranquility. See if you can go even deeper. And then perhaps these nimittas will start to arise as a consequence. Should I look out for it? No, don't look out for it. Just allow it to come by itself, right? Never look out for anything. Just relax. If it comes, fine. Doesn't come, that's fine too. Dear Ajahn, how can I deal with guilt, fear from previous actions in life when I was wretched? When I was wretched and of bad habits, reckless and of bad habits, should we be concerned of other people's perception of us, especially if they are not associates and friends? So how can I deal with the guilt from the past life when I was reckless and of bad habits? Well, Sometimes what you do is that you realize what a wonderful thing it is that you have gotten away from that, right? You're now on a different path. Now suddenly you're actually practicing in a good way, in the right. That is what is wonderful, isn't it? Most people, when they start off reckless, they continue to be reckless and they die reckless. Now that is the big tragedy. When somebody is able to change and actually move on away from recklessness, wow, what a powerful thing that is. You're really doing something good in life. You really have understood something profound. You should be happy. You should be joyful that you have understood this thing. You should congratulate yourself. Pat yourself on the back and say, well done. I'm moving in the right direction, right? Feel a sense of happiness about what you're doing. You're doing the right thing. What a wonderful thing it is. And then when you look at it from that side, you don't have to feel so bad about the past. Remember that whatever past we have, where did it come from, that recklessness? Was it you who were reckless, or was it just the conditioning that caused you to be reckless? If you look at it carefully, you will realize that the recklessness and the bad habits that you had in the past, they came from the conditioning, right? The people around you, maybe who you were in the past life, and most of it we have very little control over. We are just robots. We are robots that are, you know, following on from these past habits and the past way of doing things. So how can you blame a robot? A robot just does what robots do. So see that. Try to understand the non-self nature of these things, right? There was never really any me who wanted to be reckless. It was just this process, conditioned process, who was conditioned into that state. And you didn't really have that much choice. If you had understood then what you understand now, that recklessness and bad habits actually causes suffering, would you have been reckless? No, it's because you were deluded, you were stupid, you didn't really see. That's why you were reckless, right? So you can almost have a sense of compassion for yourself. And then if you have compassion for yourself, for who you were then you can also have compassion now for people who are reckless, friends, people you meet, who you feel, you know, these people are terrible. Are they terrible, or are they just a victim of their conditioning here? And once you understand that they are a victim of conditioning here, you can actually have compassion for them. They are deluded. They're creating suffering for themselves in the future. Nobody wants to create suffering for themselves in the future, right? They just can't see it. They're acting like their own worst enemies. Your enemies want you to suffer, and you're acting just like your own enemy. Then you can have compassion when you start to see that. And then your whole perspective changes. So try to understand yourself. If you understand yourself in this way, it will also help you to understand other people at the same time. It's a very beneficial thing, right? And then you grow in this spiritual life. So in this way, you can do away with the guilt. And in the long term, the more you practice this path, the more you become a kind, compassionate, caring person in this life, the more you are diluting all that past karma, right? The famous simile of the Buddha with a pinch of salt. For those of you who haven't heard this, it's a very, very well-known simile of the Buddha. The Buddha says, if you have a few grains of salt and you put that in a glass of water, and even a few grains will make that water very, very salty, right? The salt here stands for the bad actions you have done, and the water stands for the good actions you have done. So because the amount of bad actions is fairly significant compared to the good actions, then when you drink it, the taste is very salty. You get very bad results. You get very bad consequences in the future. But if you take the same amount of bad actions and you dilute them in a large pond of water, and then you taste, actually I think in the simile it says the river Ganges even. If you take a few grains of salt and you dilute that in the river Ganges or even a large pond of water, you won't be able to taste it, right? Or if you taste it, it's very, very marginal. So the same actions, if you do a lot of good things, will have very little result in the future. So as you continue practicing what is right and what is good, all the bad things you did in the past will be diluted in those good actions. And they will tend to disappear, and they won't have any consequences for the future. Okay, should we be concerned of other people's perception of us, especially if they are not associates and friends? No, don't worry about other people's perceptions of you. If you know that you're doing what is right, what is good, please forget about other people's perceptions. Otherwise, it's like being controlled by other people in the world, right? Sometimes we need a sense of independence to be able to do what is right. Sometimes people think we should be doing things which aren't good. Sometimes people want to like trap us, right? And we're trap us in relationships, or trap us in this or that. We can't be too worried about what other people think. We have to do, in the end, what is right and what is good. Sometimes you can be concerned about other people's perception. If other people have a valid point of view, if other people can point out something which maybe you are doing which isn't right, then of course it is useful to listen to what they have to say. But not to allow ourselves to be too controlled by other people. If, however, other people have a valid point, then the Buddha has this beautiful saying in the Dhammapada where he says that if somebody points out a fault, a true fault in your conduct, it is like somebody showing you a treasure. Is that how you think when somebody says something to you? That you, what? You have done this? And he's saying, oh, thank you for showing me the treasure. It's hard. It depends where people are coming from. If you feel that people are coming from the wrong place, it's very hard to look at it like that. But sometimes somebody says things in a nice and caring way, and they say, listen, you know, what you're doing here, it doesn't make any sense. Please think about it. And then sometimes if people do that, intending, trying to be well-meaning, it's worthwhile trying to listen, right? Perhaps they have a point. If they haven't got a point, okay, fine. But if they have a point, we actually have a chance to improve ourselves. Sometimes it's very difficult to see our own faults because they're so close to us. Sometimes it takes a third party to see them from the outside. And then it can be very helpful when somebody says something in a kind and compassionate way. Yes, okay, I hope that helps. So let's move on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, passive observance and shift the object, we do it together, or passive observance first and just do the shifting of the object. Thank you. So remember that passive observance is fine as long as no defilement is arising in the mind, right? As long as you're just sitting there, the mind is just thinking a little bit here, a little bit there, nothing kind of very defiled. It's a bit restless or you're a bit tired or whatever. There's all these things happening in the mind. As long as there's nothing kind of bad happening, you can just observe, right? But then suddenly you get caught by this sense of upset or anger. You remember something from the past. This can happen in meditation. I'm sure it's happened to everyone here. Suddenly a thought from the past arises and you get upset. That is where the shift in attention comes in, right? So you're sitting there and you can see it's about to happen. Before that anger takes hold in your mind, that ill will takes hold in your mind, you shift away and you shift to something else. That's where these things happen. Or you sit there and suddenly this fantasy about some very nice sensual pleasure arises in your mind, right? And before you know it, your mind is on fire with this kind of fantasy inside. Then before the mind catches fire, so to speak, you move your attention away and you see something else instead, right? You think about, you know, you get hungry in the evening and you think about this wonderful meal you're supposed to have. And suddenly your whole mind is caught up with this beautiful meal that you wish you could have in the evening, which you can't have when you're here. So then before that takes hold, you remind yourself, no, this is not the time. This is going to mess up my whole meditation. It's going to just lead to all kinds of desires and stupidity. Don't go that direction. This is my chance. Who knows if I ever will be on another meditation retreat in the rest of my life. I'm here in this beautiful setting. Am I going to waste my time thinking about a meal I cannot have anyway? It's madness, right? And you know it's madness. So quickly change your perception away. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn, it is said by some that renouncing the material world as a monk and leaving the rest of the world to its suffering is selfish. What would you say to such a comment? We're not leaving the rest of the world to its suffering, right? We come out, we teach a little bit. That's why I'm sitting up here. Otherwise, I would be sitting in my cutie instead. Look at somebody like Ajahn Brahm. Right? He travels the whole world. He teaches thousands of people wherever he goes. And I have heard some Mahayana monastics, they say, oh, you're more of a bodhisattva than we are. You know, how come you are? You're supposed to be a selfish Theravadin, but you're doing all this more work than we are. What's going on there? Maybe you should become a Mahayana monk instead. So it's not like that, right? And the whole point is that selfishness doesn't work. If you are sitting in a kuti and say, no, I'm not going to share with anyone, I'm just going to do my own practice, it doesn't work, because selfishness obstructs the path. It's going to block you from actually being able to develop your practice. You have to have this idea of generosity inside of you. Without generosity, you're not going to go anywhere. In fact, it says in the sutta that to be able to enter a deep state of samadhi, you have to have this very open heart, this generosity, where you're willing and willing to share with everybody at any time. And you can see that with somebody like Ajahn Brahm. He's always willing to share, always willing to help out whenever he can. It is kind of his whole life is about sharing and helping out. And you almost have to force him, lock him up in his kuti for a fortnight every year so he can have a nice retreat for himself. And this is the nature. You become very selfless if you are developed on the path. So to just lock yourself up in a kuti and say, I'm not going to do anything for everyone, it just doesn't work. It is not. The path of a monastic is not a selfish path at all. Perhaps it seems that way. No, it's a path of generosity. It's a path of sharing. And only then does the monastic path actually work. Any path works. The Buddhist path only works then. Okay. Could the volume be increased a little during your Dhamma sharing? I'm a bit hard of hearing. Okay, is the Dhamma volume too low now? Dhamma volume, is it okay? Too low? Can everybody hear? A bit more up? You deafen your ear? Okay. Is it? Okay. Okay. Oh. Okay, so we're trying our best. Now it's a bit louder, isn't it? You came a bit higher up, yeah? Okay. So, yeah. Good. That was an easy one. I fixed up quickly here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, is it possible to get awakening without monastic life? For example, I stay alone in an apartment and keep my precepts. Is it possible? In theory, it is possible. In theory, you can become a stream mentor, a once returner, a non-returner. You can even get full awakening. And then, presumably, you would become a monastic once you awaken, because you just feel like a monastic, right? If you're an arahant, you feel 100% like a monastic. You don't feel like a layperson anymore. You've given up everything, all attachments, all ideas of storing up things in household life, all these kind of things, is all gone. So you are, at heart and in mind, you are a monastic. It is possible, but, you know, I think it's the wrong question to ask whether it's possible. It's not really the right question. The right question should rather be, how can I maximize my opportunities to move forward on this path? That is a much more useful question. And the way to maximize your opportunities is to practice the life of a Buddhist to the best of your ability, and then see what happens, right? And then if you then find as you do that, that you start to incline towards monastic life, then great. And then you try out the monastic life, perhaps. You go to the monastery for a while, you check it out, you see if it is for you. And if it is for you and you climb that direction, then maybe you can become a monastic. If not, you don't become a monastic. But regardless of what you do, you just do the best of your ability. And you follow the heart. What the heart tells you is what you should be doing. Don't force yourself to be a monastic. Don't force yourself to be a lay person. Don't force yourself to be anything. Just do what comes reasonably naturally. Sometimes a little bit of force may be required, but generally speaking, follow what works and what goes for you. So, staying alone in the apartment and keeping your precepts, again, it's good. It's good to, you know, have that space around you and all that. But as I was saying before, there are some incredibly great advantages with living a monastic life. You're having very strong support for the Buddhist life as a monastic, which you don't have as a layperson. Sometimes I think with horror of returning to lay life and how that would kind of impede my ability to live a good life as a Buddhist. I think it would be very much harder for me to practice properly as a Buddhist if I was in lay life. Sometimes I just go back and visit my family for a week, right? I go back to all the way to Norway, where my family lives, and I hang out with them for a week, and I realize that how difficult it is to practice the Dhamma in that kind of situation. It's much, much harder. And then I kind of, come back to Australia quickly again afterwards. Okay. And I, by the way, I have a very good relationship with my family. It's just the nature of things. Okay. Dear Ajahn, does a newborn baby have an active mind and thinking process? Okay. The mind is active in the sense that the mind is doing things, right? Because it is moving around. To be able to move, you have to have activity in the mind. So it's obviously doing things, but if it thinks, it's a very kind of rudimentary kind of thinking, right? It's more like maybe you just have, probably it obviously has craving, right? And craving is an activity in the mind. It obviously has craving. It wants food, right? It starts screaming and whatever. So obviously there's craving there. So there is certainly activity going on in the mind. Is it easier for a small child or a baby, maybe not, but for a small child to enter a state of samadhi? And there is some evidence that for a child it is easier than it is for someone who's fully, for a grown adult, because as a child you're not so kind of perhaps you're not thinking so much about all you have no responsibilities in life yet, right? Life is very simple. You haven't got all these things impinging on you all the time. So because of that, sometimes you just sit down and you kind of feel blissed out. And that's what happened with the Buddha, right? Before the Buddha became the Buddha, when he was the Buddha to be, he just sat down under the rose apple tree, and he automatically went into a state of samadhi, into a jhana state. And this is said to be not common perhaps, but not that uncommon amongst young children, that they can automatically enter states of peace like that. So perhaps because of the kind of innocence and lack of responsibilities of childhood. Dear Ajahn, does nimitta appear only as a light, or can it appear as a figure, colors, an object, etc.? Well, the word nimitta basically just means an object of the mind, or something you see in the mind. That's the basic meaning of the word nimitta. So the nimitta is anything that happens in the mind. So you close your eyes and you have a visual nimitta and you see things. So it can be anything. And some people have very, very visual minds, and they close their eyes and they see all kind of stuff. They see landscapes and they see people and all kind of things. And that is also, in a sense, nimitta. Other people, they get good meditation and all kind of things start to happen. They see things which they think are past lives, and they see things which are predictions of the future perhaps, and all this kind of stuff. And this is because when the mind becomes peaceful, the mind becomes very creative, and it starts to create all this stuff out of nothing. So this is part of the problem, and it can be very fascinating. People say it's really fascinating. You see all this stuff and you wonder what it is. But it's not really that conducive to what we are trying to do on the Buddhist path, because it's really just a bit of a distraction. It's interesting, but you don't really know what you're seeing, whether it's true or whether it's beneficial, whether it really has any relevance. Most likely it doesn't have any real relevance. It's just stuff that the mind is creating for you. So you want to simplify things. Instead of actually, if you want to play around with that a bit, fine. We always need a bit of playtime. It's always good to have a bit of playtime. But then when you kind of think, okay, enough of this, then you go back to focusing on a single object again. The breath, a nimitta which is stable, right? The ideal nimitta is the nimitta which is bright and powerful and stable. That is the ideal nimitta, because that will take you towards more stillness. That will eventually take you all the way to samadhi. So the best nimittas are the bright ones, the blissful ones, the stable ones, the simple ones. These are the really good ones. Seeing the sun, right? This kind of stuff. There was once a woman who told me this story. I can't remember where I, maybe I, whether she wrote to me or whether she, I can't remember anymore. And she said that she went to a monastery, I think it was in Australia. She was of Asian origin, I think from Vietnam or something like that. But she had come to Australia when she was reasonably young. And she went to this Mahayana monastery in Melbourne or something like that. And she went to this Mahayana monastery and she saw this statue there. I think it was a Kuan Yin statue or something. And she went there to bow down. She must have been a very pure person. Sometimes you meet people who are very, very pure. And she went there and she asked this master who was there, "Can I just sit here peacefully for a while?" So she went to bow down to this Kuan Yin statue and just sat peacefully. And she said, while she was doing this, she was having her eyes closed, right? And suddenly this light appeared, which was so incredibly brilliant. She had to put her hands up to try to kind of block it out. But her eyes were closed, right? It wasn't coming from the inside. It was coming from the inside. The light was so powerful that she had to try to blot it out. And that is kind of the sort of the nimittas and how powerful they can be. You think they're going to blind you. That is the sort of stuff. So that is the thing that can happen. Once you purify to that extent, these are the sort of things that can arise. Okay. "Dear Ajahn, I had a peaceful and calm meditation for an hour after I tell my mind to rest and do not wander around. I sent metta to my mind. Thank you. It was wonderful, a wonderful experience with metta." Okay, great, excellent, well done. So that is the sort of thing that you want to keep doing. So keep doing that. Don't have any expectations. Sometimes what happens if you have a nice experience is that you think it's going to come back again. You think, now I know how to do this, and the next time you try, it doesn't work, right? So this is often the frustration of having this experience. For a while afterwards, it takes, you end up being frustrated. So don't expect anything. Have this experience. Don't expect it to happen again. Just sit down next time and be happy with whatever happens. And then you'll be okay. And then in due course, you may have this sort of experience again. And it becomes maybe even more powerful next time around. So please don't allow the beauty of the meditation to give rise to expectations. Because those expectations will block you from getting there again in the future. Okay. "Dear Ajahn, where does Kuan Yin fit into the Buddha's teachings? She isn't often mentioned here, and I haven't seen any statues of her at Lama Grove. Is she a different tradition, perhaps?" In a sense, that is correct. In a sense, she's a different tradition. If you go to Dhammasara Monastery, they actually have a big statue of Kuan Yin at Dhammasara Monastery here. You can go there and check it out. Basically, Kuan Yin is part of this idea of bodhisattvas. And the idea of bodhisattvas is something that arose a long time after the Buddha. It actually started perhaps a little bit quite soon after the Buddha, but the fully developed idea of the bodhisattva came a long time afterwards. And bodhisattvas are these beings who practice in the world to help everybody else, right? And they even sometimes put off their own awakening and saying, I'm going to help everybody else before I awaken myself. This is the idea of the bodhisattva. This idea of compassion, right? Or helping everybody around. And Kuan Yin originally was a different bodhisattva. Kuan Yin originally was a bodhisattva known as Avalokiteshvara. This is one of the original bodhisattvas that were taught about in India a few centuries after the Buddha passed away. And then these teachings of Avalokiteshvara eventually reached China, because many of the early suttas, the suttas both Mahayana and Theravada and early suttas that were translated into Chinese, they went to China. And in China, Avalokiteshvara went through this transformation and became known as Kuan Yin instead. Kuan Yin apparently is a Chinese translation of Avalokiteshvara, supposed to have roughly the same meaning, or there is a relationship there between the word Kuan Yin and the Sanskrit word Avalokiteshvara. And in the process of transformation, there was also a sex change. So Avalokiteshvara was male and Kuan Yin is female in China. That's an interesting idea. I think the Chinese, they couldn't understand how a male could have so much compassion, so they made it into a female, something like that, made it into a female instead. That seems to have been the idea behind that. So that is Kuan Yin. So Kuan Yin is really a Chinese, part of Chinese Buddhism. That's what it's about. But Kuan Yin is very revered, I understand, in Chinese Buddhism. It's a very, very important bodhisattva in Chinese Buddhism. And if you go to China, apparently, you can see Kuan Yin pretty much everywhere. You don't actually have to go to China. You go to Thailand, go to many places, you will see Kuan Yin. And of course, one of the nice things about Kuan Yin is precisely that Kuan Yin is a female. So it relates, sometimes it relates well, right? If you are a woman and you want to have like a woman role model, then it's nice to have something that you can look up to. Here is the female incarnation of compassion, right? Sometimes that's a nice thing to have. One of the things that you find in the suttas is that in the suttas, the monks, they have monks who are role models. The laymen, they have laymen who are their role models. But the nuns, they have bhikkhunis as their role models. And the lay women have lay women as their role models. And the reason is because we need someone we can relate to well, right? So it's good that we have someone of our own gender that we can relate to, because then that is more easy for us to understand sometimes. So for that reason, I think it's important even for these things to happen. Sometimes it doesn't have to be Kuan Yin. There's lots of amazing nuns at the time of the Buddha. You can start reading about them in some of the ancient scriptures of Buddhism, and you can have those as your role models instead. It doesn't have to be Kuan Yin, but Kuan Yin is certainly one possibility here. Okay, so that is more part of the Mahayana tradition here. Okay, dear Ajahn, the hospital word, I am ward, I'm working. There is a particular patient who suffers from nightmares. Any help I do by talking is not much effect. Question A, is there any other way I can help? What is the cause for those nightmares? Okay, so is there any help you can do? And basically what you have to do is nightmare can have many causes, but one of them is a lack of metta, right? A lack of compassion, a lack of a good heart. It says in the suttas that one of the great benefits of metta, of loving kindness, is that you sleep well at night. You wake up in the morning, you wake up well. So maybe the best thing you can do is sit down with your patient and do a guided metta meditation for them, right? Sit down and say, follow my advice. Imagine all the good qualities in the people out there. Imagine someone you really respect for their wonderful qualities. How beautiful that is. Think of all the good qualities in yourself. Think about all the, in the northern direction, all the amazing people out there, you know, with beautiful spiritual qualities. And then wish them well. Guide them through something like that, or find a nice metta meditation for them, a nice guided metta meditation to carry them through. This is the best way to make people sleep well. So more metta is really the way forward. What is the cause for those nightmares? Again, it is hard to say. There can be many different things. But ultimately, it is the mind is not positive enough. The mind hasn't got enough of metta. That's ultimately the cause. But there can be many things. There can be things from the past life. There can be trauma from this life. There can be, sometimes it doesn't really matter what the reason is. What matters is that there is a problem. Let's try to solve it. That's the important issue here. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, we all have a need for recognition, appreciation, to be liked, admired, etc. Do thoughts relating to this come under thoughts of sensuality? Is it bhava tanha? These are more difficult to tackle and more disturbing than thoughts about chocolate and cheese. Yes, that is true. They are very, and that's why they are the kind of the refined defilements, right? They come very high on that list. If you remember back to the sutta on the first day, we were talking about thoughts about your relations, about your country, about your reputation. That is the very most refined defilements that we have. And yes, I would say they are part of bhava tanha, right? Bhava tanha means tanha is craving, bhava is like existence. So it is the craving for existence. We want to be a certain person. We want to have a certain personality. We want to be recognized in a certain way. And that is part of the problem. So yes, it is more difficult and more, and they can be more disturbing. And sometimes the mind just disturbs you because it wants to remind you that you exist, right? You want to feel that you exist. You want to support your ego. You want to support your sense of self. And that is often done through thinking about yourself in a certain way. So thinking what you have done in the past or who you are. And that supports your sense of identity. Or, as I was saying the other day, you think of yourself in terms of being a certain gender, and that gives you a gender identity, and that is what leads to relationships usually. So, yes, indeed, it is more disturbing, and it is a greater problem, and this is one of the great things I think we do in meditation practice. We are reducing the bhava tanha, we are reducing our sense of identity. As the mind calms down, one of the great things that the mindfulness of breathing does, it reduces the thinking mind. And the only way that can happen is that you're reducing also your sense of identity at the same time. You're giving up who you are. You're giving up your nationality, your background, your education, all those things. And you just become a being, right? It's very freeing. It's very kind of, you become very tolerant at that point because you realize that in deep inside, we're all the same. The mind is the same for all of us. We all have the same potential for the beautiful mind states inside. And at that point, discrimination, gender differences, differences in education and background and nationality, all that starts to evaporate. And you become more encompassing. You become more capable of having loving kindness for everybody. Right? This is part and parcel of what's going on. Because it's a very beautiful thing to get rid of that sense of identity. And just being much more open to everything here. So it's actually a wonderful thing to do. Yeah, so indeed. So okay, question number two. What is the monk that lived in a three-walled cuti for 40 years? Have you met him? If someone has strong inclinations towards seclusion and solitude, could it also be because they are cranky and not very good at living in a community? Okay, I haven't met him, but I know many, many people who have, and I have we have a picture of him on the wall in the at Bodhinanda Monastery actually, I think if you live in the forest by yourself for such a long period, if you have a very bad character, if you are very angry or have a lot of desires, you will go crazy. Remember what the Buddha says. He says that unless you have the jhanas, unless you have real deep samadhi, if you go into seclusion, there are chances are that you will go crazy. That's what he says. Because your defilements will get the better of you. So the only explanation, if somebody is able to live like that for 40 years, is that they are quite pure. They may not be arahants, they may not... But they have something, they have some purity inside, which enables them to practice in that way. And in fact, this is exactly what the Buddha says. When a lay person asks the Buddha, well, how do I know that these people are... You know, the Buddha says, okay, you look at people, you see whether they have defilements. The lay person says, well, how do I know? And the Buddha says, yes, it is quite difficult for you as a lay person to be able to judge monastics or judge people whether they have defilements or not. So instead, just look at how they live. Do they live far away in the forest? Do they live secluded? Do they live outside of sensual pleasures, outside of society? And if they live outside of that, then they must have something which enables them to sustain that life. And that is what actually works. And Bodhinyana Monastery is obviously a forest monastery. So there's a little bit of that at Bodhinyana Monastery. We're already living outside of the city. But still, it is a very... You know, when you live completely by yourself in a cute in the forest, that's a completely different ball game again, right? I mean, really different ball game. And then you really, really have to have your act together. At Bodhinyana, you still have a sangha around you. Yes, you can go on retreat for as long as you like, but there's always that possibility of having a bit of interaction. So Bodhinama is like it's very good, but it's obviously this kind of dedication, this kind of practice takes much more than staying at Bodhinama Monastery here. So if you are cranky, come. If you are cranky, that's when you really should stay in the community, to get over that crankiness and get it out of your system, and then you should go into the forest. That's the right way. So sometimes you need good guidance, you need a good teacher to tell you what you should be doing. Very often, I've actually seen that people who they don't actually go off into solitude precisely as you say, because they cannot really make it in the community. But if you can't make it in the community, you can't make it in solitude either. Only when you start to be able to understand how to live in the community, because you have enough compassion and metta for the people around you, only then is it possible to live in solitude. It's such an important thing to understand. If you can live with others, you can live in solitude. If you can live in solitude, you can live with others. If you can't live with others, you can also not live in solitude. The two things really go together. Okay. Dear Adam, what's the difference between mindfulness and awareness? And what's mind? Mind and thoughts, are they the same thing? What is the difference between mindfulness and awareness? It's just two different words, and it's just a question of how you use them, right? So how do we, usually when we use the word mindfulness, we specifically refer to what is called satipatthana in Pali language. Satipatthana is the seventh factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, and that is usually what we mean by mindfulness. So it's a very specific type of awareness. It's an awareness that is directed at the four areas in the Satipatthana Sutta: body, feelings, mind, and perhaps principles or phenomena as the last one. And it is an awareness that is also quite strong. It is an awareness that arises only when the mind is quite peaceful, when there's very little thinking, when the mind is already quite strongly present. You have to have a strong sense of presence to be able to do meditation like Satipatthana or watching the breath and all these kind of things. The presence has to be there already. One of the biggest problems in meditation practice is people start to watch the breath too early. They're not ready. Mindfulness is not strong enough. And you try to watch the breath, and all you end up doing is clutching the breath, holding on to it, grasping onto it, because that's the only way it's going to happen if mindfulness isn't strong enough. So this is one of the problems. So this whole thing that I've been teaching now, up to now, I'm going to be teaching the next few days, all of this are just instructions for how to reach that mindfulness when you can start watching the breath naturally, and where satipatthana becomes possible. So that is the usual way that mindfulness is used in English, whereas awareness is usually used more broadly in the Buddhist context. So awareness is also perhaps weaker awareness, right? You are aware that a bad thought is coming up in your mind. You are aware that you are walking back and forth on the walking meditation path. You are aware that you are thinking. But it's not awareness that is strong enough yet to actually be deserve the name mindfulness. What is mind? Mind is what happens when you sit down, right? And you close your eyes and you don't really see anything, you don't hear anything. Everything that kind of happens inside your head, right? Or in your heart. And all the feelings that you have, right? You're feeling sad, you're feeling good. All the visual things that you, when you dream at night, that's all mind stuff, right? So this is mind. Everything that happens in the, which is not part of the senses and the external world, everything that happens inside of you, that's mind. What is the difference between mind and thought? Well, thought is one aspect of mind, only one aspect. And then there's all these other things, like feelings, right? Or perceptions, or awareness, or volition, the will, the doer inside. These are the most usual aspects of the mind that you read about in the sutta. So thought is just one aspect of mind. Mind is more than the thinking mind. Okay? I'm just going to continue. I hope you will allow me to do that. Only two more questions. It's getting a little bit late, but I think it's nice to probably finish off. So I will do that. Okay, dear Ajahn, how does one translate the idea of sensual abstinence to the life of a layperson living a family life who would like to develop in this area but still has some family obligations? There is no such thing as complete sensual abstinence. There is always going to be some sensual pleasures in the world. If you're living in a family life, this is kind of the main difference between living a family life and a monastic life. If you want to live a life of complete sexual abstinence rather than sensual abstinence, then it basically you are a monastic already. You might as well come to the monastery and join us down the monastery because you're already there, right? You're kind of on that path. But if you're going to live a family life, it is probably going to be very difficult for you to live that sort of life. The nice thing about a monastery is that you are quite secluded. You're quite away from the world. You don't get all these impressions that you get in the world, which always stirs up the defilements. You're kind of withdrawn from that. And that is a very supportive thing to be able to live that sort of life. In the worldly life, there's always kind of these impressions, always hammering you, and always telling you how wonderful it is to kind of, you know, enjoy all kinds of sensual pleasures. If it is possible for you to do that, if you really incline that way strongly and you think that you're able to live that sort of life as a layperson, it's wonderful. Please do so. But don't set the bar too high. Don't aim for something that is unreachable. Sometimes we set the bar too high and all we end up doing is causing suffering for ourselves. Remember that this is what lay life is about. There is more sensual pleasures in lay life than in monastic life. Find that balance where you can do things easily. If you can do it easily, great, but don't force yourself too much. Sometimes this is the thing you have to wait for until you become a monastic. Okay. Last question. Okay, Ajahn, please explain Magga and Pala. Thank you. Okay, Magga and Pala. So very briefly, these are two words. Magga means path, Pala means fruit. And these are two words that you find in the commentaries, in the commentarial literatures. You don't really find them so much in the suttas. And this is the idea that they have, that you, when you have reached a stage of awakening, right, you become a stream entry. These are the really, really profound stuff that you happen on the path. It goes through two stages. One is the magga. The magga is like when the defilements are destroyed, and the pala comes afterwards. You experience the bliss of that destruction of the defilements. This is how the system is made up in the Abhidhamma and the commentaries. But in the suttas, it doesn't really quite work like that. In the suttas, they don't have that sort of distinction. It might very well be that that's roughly how it happens, but in the suttas, it is slightly different. In the suttas, they talk about someone who is practicing for the fruit of becoming a stream enter and someone who is a stream enter. In other words, there comes a point when your development is so powerful that there is no turning back anymore. You will become a stream enter in this lifetime. That is the one who's practicing for stream entry. And that is sometimes called magga in the commentaries, but actually it is something a little bit different. And then eventually comes that realization when you are a stream enter. There's a little bit of clash there between how things are viewed in the suttas and how they're viewed in the commentaries. These are just kind of... That doesn't really matter so much, I think. If you're interested in those areas and you want to kind of sort those things out, you're welcome to come to ask me at the interview time or something like that. Sometimes these things get a bit theoretical and a bit too perhaps far away from what we really need to do in this practice. So, it's getting late. I'm getting a bit tired, I suppose. So, okay, so that's it for tonight. So I'll see you again tomorrow morning. Yeah.